from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up this morning on Forum, San Francisco politics are rarely dull, and this election year is no exception. Voters will weigh in on a whopping 25 ballot measures covering hot-button issues like homelessness, public transit, and education. And in this hour, coming up, we'll talk with local political journalists about the big measures and the races, and we'll also discuss what it all means for Mayor Ed Lee, a divided board of supervisors, and the future of the city. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. There are major issue ballot measures for San Francisco voters in the upcoming November election, and there are a lot of them to sort through and decide upon, 25 to be exact. This Forum Hour is part of our ongoing 2016 election coverage. We provide what we hope will be a listener's guide to what the major local initiatives are and what they have in them, with the able assistance of three of San Francisco's leading political journalists who all join us in studio for this hour. And let me introduce them to you. Some of them really need, or all of them really need, no introduction. CW needs. Nevius is here, Metro columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. Good morning, Chuck.
Great to be here, Michael.
Good to have you here. Also, Tim Redman, who is editor of 48hills.org, an online daily newspaper. Welcome, Tim.
Happy to be here.
And Marisa Lagos, in-studio reporter for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. And welcome, Marisa.
Happy Monday.
Well, same to you. And glad to have you all aboard, needless to say. Marisa, let me begin with you. This has so many things. It's daunting to talk because there's really an impossibility of talking about all these issues. And what I think about is the burden and the onus on the voters to really not only look at all these carefully, but really get behind them. You got an over 200-page voting guide. You've got Joe Eskenazi was writing in SF Magazine about how poor the poor postmen have to carry these things. I mean, it's really quite daunting.
It is. And this is just the local measures, right?
Props exactly.
A through X, and then we have 17 state ballot
and
measures.
And RR.
Shoot.
The BART measure.
Don't forget that.
I'm just talking about San Francisco now.
Yeah, no, I know. But I'm saying when you talk about voter fatigue, it's like before they even get to these ballot measures, they're going to be tired. And you know what strikes me looking at this is just how much of this is these proxy battles between different factions in San Francisco. And I will say, no matter where you stand on issues from, affordable housing to homelessness to whether we should have a public advocate or who should appoint MTA commissioners, part of me just wants to say, can you guys do your jobs at City Hall so we don't have to?
You say the same thing to state legislators. Yeah. A lot of these initiatives wouldn't be on the ballot.
Absolutely.
If they were getting legislation through. But it's a process that maybe is too easy. That's the argument you hear, to get something on the ballot. Only 5% of the votes, really, in most recent cases?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I also think you just have to look at the politics of San Francisco. And as somebody who's been up in Sacramento and back and forth a lot, I always say that, because of the fact that everybody is a liberal Democrat here, their political battles end up being a lot nastier because they're not actually that far apart if you were to look at the sort of grand scheme of politics. But, on issues like affordable housing, there are some really big divisions. There's also a state Senate race happening between two board members, Jane Kim and Scott Wiener. We see several measures here where they're sort of each trying to burnish their own credentials with, the people that they see as their constituents. You have the realtors who have two measures on here who are looking to hit back in some ways at affordable housing advocates. So again, a lot of proxy battles, a lot between the progressives and the moderate on the board, between the mayor, between real estate, and a lot for voters to sort out, like you said.
Well,
hopefully we'll help.
Let's try to sort some of those out, and your help is most welcome. Let me go to Tim Redman, what about this division of moderates and progressives? One keeps hearing about it, and one keeps hearing that many of these ballot measures are being used politically for one reason or another. Tools for fundraising, for example.
Well, some of them clearly are, and I would disagree a little bit with Marissa in the sense I think there is a significant difference between how the different factions in San Francisco view politics, particularly when it comes to whether we should generally allow free market solutions or whether we should generally allow more government-oriented solutions. I think there's a significant difference in San Francisco, basically because so much policy has to be made at the city level now because the state isn't doing its job. But the fact of the matter is, Mayor Ed Lee is not on the ballot.
We have a referendum maybe going on here?
It kind of is. I mean, a lot of this stuff is really about the mayor's power and responses to the mayor. And it's interesting that, you know, he's so unpopular now. I have never seen an election, and I go back to 1981, when the mayor of San Francisco has not a single ballot argument, has not endorsed a single candidate or a single proposition, is entirely, completely missing in action. And yet, some of these things are essentially proxies on the mayor's power. I mean, we have four ballot measures, D, H, L, and M, that all in one way or another would reduce the power of what is right now an exceptionally powerful mayor. I mean, the mayor of San Francisco, just from a political science chief executive point of view, is a very, very powerful executive. And this would, these four measures would significantly reduce the mayor's power. So part of what I think people are doing is saying, okay, if you're unhappy with the mayor, here's ways to reduce his power. And then you've got...
And some have suggested the Rasputin hand of Aaron Peskin largely behind
these. Well, it's actually not entirely Aaron Peskin. The thing, and another thing to Marissa's point, you know, a lot of these are on the ballot because San Francisco has this really ungainly city charter where to make a lot of changes, you have to go to the voters. And to pass taxes, you have to go to the voters under state law. So we're kind of stuck with some of this. I'm not sure. I think, for example, Prop H... the public advocate measure. Aaron Peskin didn't really like that. And he's supported it, but it definitely wasn't coming from him. That was coming from David Campos and Tom Amiano. Proposition D, which is a very important measure that would change the way we fill vacancies on the Board of Supervisors, which are now just filled by the mayor. That didn't come out of Aaron Peskin either. That actually came out of John Avalos, who's been trying to do this for about 6 years. So it's not all really quite like that. It's kind of a mix of different people pushing some of their own political agendas and some basically saying, as I say, I think what John Avalos is saying is, hey, I've been trying for 6 years to say the mayor shouldn't be able to just fill slots on the Board of Supervisors. Now we've got a presidential election, which is the other factor here. Turnout's going to be high. Everybody's saying, hey, this is the ballot. You want something to pass that's a progressive idea? Let's put it on this ballot.
On the other hand, Marissa said something about boils down about $250,000 from real estate, that is Association of Realtors behind P and U. P would shift affordable housing from essentially nonprofits to developers, and U essentially would make affordable housing into higher profit housing or turn new affordable housing into higher profit housing. Now, Chuck Navias, you're behind both of these. I would suspect that Tim probably would oppose you on this.
I think you might be onto something there, Michael. I think Tim is against these, yes. Well, I agree with Marissa. I think that you've got a situation where, and I think voters are starting to say this, the sense here in San Francisco is there's nothing that can't be solved without a nice election. Let's just go have an election. When we go up to X for ballot measures, I think we've got to the point where we're not seeing elected officials who have been asked and tasked to accomplish things in their legislature advocating and letting everything go to a vote. We can't vote on everything. And I would say to John Avalos, if it's been 6 years and you've been trying to do it, it might be time to take the hint. I'm not sure that anybody does think, I mean, that the majority of people do think that a strong mayor is not a bad idea. And I would also say just to Tim, I think that the homeless tax The homeless and transportation and the general sales tax, J and K, were both promoted by the mayor. And I think that is a referendum on the mayor as well. But I think that we're going to hear from voters. They're going to say this thing is longer than Catcher in the Rye. This thing is longer than most novels. We need to pare it down. We'd like to see you guys work together. In 2000, when we got district elections, the idea was going to give people a voice, different people a voice, exercise that voice, get together, and accomplish something rather than put it on the ballot.
Let's talk a little bit with Marissa, because I know that the two of you will probably go at it on this too. prohibit tents on sidewalks. I mean, that's a Proposition Q.
I mean, you know, I think that this is Mark Farrell's measure. And, you know, depending on who you ask, it's either going to make it easier or harder to remove tents on sidewalks. I think we'll hear from both sides on that. But this is another one where I think that you have frustration at, you know, a seemingly intractable problem, which is homelessness. You have this being so much more visible in recent years. I know you guys have done a whole hour on this. I mean, we could spend hours debating it.
Just did it, in fact, yeah.
But, you know, I think that it gets to this question, whether or not the nitty-gritty of this measure is really going to make any difference for, you know, our homeless problem. It does set up a sort of easy question for a lot of voters, because there are people that are going to come down and say, absolutely, we need to clear these tents. And there are people that are going to say, no, that's inhumane, like the Coalition on Homelessness is. And I don't want to be like Debbie Downer over here, but I just don't. I don't think it's going to make a huge difference.
And what about? Well, let me get into something else.
And they're agreeing. Wait. Tim and Chuck are agreeing.
The
Chronicle.
A kind of milestone, isn't it?
We both agree that this it's already illegal to put tents on sidewalks.
Right. Like, why are we even doing this?
Right. We're doing it because Mark Farrell is looking for a wedge issue that will play out and a win, and it will play out in the state Senate race because Scott Wiener's allies are attacking Jane Kim over tents on the sidewalk. And so, I mean, this is, as I say, I will quote the San Francisco Chronicle editorial page. This is a pointless measure.
Can we get this on tape here?
I think
Chuck is in disagreement with a lot of the Chronicle positions. Yeah. But I don't know if you two are in agreement or disagreement about, because we're talking about homelessness now, there is a measure to have a sales tax on the ballot, J&K, actually, two measures, that would require a simple majority and essentially would pump about $1.2 billion into homeless housing. Now, this is a big issue, as we've indicated, and you know, you see what's happened over in other places, stepping up the attempt to do some, I mean, other Bay Area cities and dealing with homelessness through more money. But then a lot of people sit back and say, you know, it's just an intractable problem.
Well, I think, and it's true, we're not just seeing it in San Francisco, and we're not just seeing it in the Bay Area. We're seeing it up and down the West Coast. This homeless tent thing is a big deal. And I have to agree with both of my esteemed colleagues. This is more of a reaction than a solution. I mean, people are upset about this. They're upset about the crime. They're upset about the people on the sidewalks. But at the end of the day, every one of these proposals comes up against the same problem, which is, where are you going to put them? And if you tell someone they have to leave the street, then there has to be a place for them to go, or they're just going to go around the corner, and that's what we have at this point. We have people moving from one side of the street to the other. So
I should mention, this is CW Navy who's talking here, in case anybody didn't know. Yeah, go ahead, Chuck.
I just feel like that's going to be the issue. And I'll be Debbie Downer for a moment. My concern is that there is such a pervasive homeless problem in the United States that I'm not sure we can keep up. I'm not sure we can build enough housing to house every single person that comes. Right now, if you're homeless and you come to San Francisco and you sit down on the sidewalk, you are San Francisco's problem. And it is up to the city to find you a place to live. And we have an enormous number of people here, and I think we have an enormous number of people who will be here. 10,000 people a year come to San Francisco of all different economic levels. I think we're going to have a very tough time keeping up with this. I would prefer to see a statewide and hopefully a nationwide look at the homeless problem.
Well, we're going to have a look also at the campaigns. I mean, we're getting short on time here. But what about, let's talk about what RR is going to do. That's also a big issue. That's the BART issue, Marisa?
Yeah, I mean, this is like any BART issue. It's going to be voted on in a number of places, right? So you have to sort of look at it a little broader than San Francisco. And also, I should mention, I mean, Prop J has $100 million set aside for transportation, too, which is linked to that sales tax you mentioned. So you guys are a lot more familiar with the BART issue than I am. I think that
Tim, you want to run it down for us?
Yeah, I mean, basically, we have a system that was built in the 1960s. The cars are aging, and the demand has gone up tremendously. And part of that is the region has been growing. Part of it is that more and more people who used to live in San Francisco but still work here have had to move to more outlying areas. So this is about bringing in a whole lot more money to rebuild the BART system. And, you know, one can argue this lots of ways. Obviously, BART is not the only solution for regional transportation. It's very, very expensive. The BART board that we have now has focused really on building tracked outlying areas. They haven't really focused on the core areas. They haven't focused on improving service in the central area. They're building further and further out, and that's very expensive, and those rides are very expensive. But whatever the policy is, and whatever you think about the BART board's decisions, it's really hard to argue that we don't need to improve our regional transportation system.
And I think it's interesting, though, because you do have people like State Senator Steve Glazer, who, of course, got elected to office in part by challenging the BART unions, saying, I don't like the way that the BART board has functioned. I don't think people should support this. And I think that, you know, that's one of those questions that can get it's a slippery slope, right? You can disagree with a government agency and the way that they function, but as Tim mentioned, we have so many more people riding BART, and we really haven't invested in it. So is punishing, you know, is it cutting off your nose to spite your face in a way to vote against something like this?
Right. All right. Like I said, I want to get into the campaigns, too. But, Chuck, let me go to you first, because we got two bills that, again, just need a majority to pass. I know you're behind them both, but maybe you can spell out what they are. We're talking about essentially teens voting, and we did a whole program on that on Forum, but immigrants also added to the voter rolls.
Right. Well,
and we ought to mention what these are. We're talking about F and N.
Yes, and the immigrant voting idea is that people who have children in the San Francisco school district would be able to vote. And I don't see anything wrong with that at all. They're going to be involved in it. They're here to stay.
You know, a lot of people bothered by it. You know that.
Well, I know they are, but I think you've got to look at the reality, which is there's an enormous number of people here who do not have citizenship papers, and yet their children are going to school here. Their children are going to be citizens of the United States. And if they want to participate, and I think that's the real key with the 16-year-old voting thing, is we haven't proved that the 18-year-olds want to vote. The millennials have been a very difficult nut to crack for all politicians. So I would favorite in terms of democracy. They're driving cars. They're doing lots of other things. But I would like to know that they are actually going to exercise this right if they get it.
Can I speak to that for a second? These propositions. Go ahead, Tim.
I was just going to say, the advantage I see as a parent of two teenagers, the advantage of the 16-year-old is when you're 16, you're living in a stable place most of the time, we hope, not all 16-year-olds. But you can register to vote at home. You can get involved. When you're 18, you're off at college. You've moved out of the house. I mean, I remember when I turned 18 and went to college, the last thing I was thinking about was registering to vote in Connecticut when I had grown up in New York. And where am I voting? Am I voting from here or from there? So I actually think getting people in the habit of voting when they're 16 may help with the millennial problem you're talking about.
Well, I did say I wanted to get to the campaign, and again, a limited time here, but I want to encourage listeners who have questions about any of these measures to at least avail yourself of the opportunity to speak with our three political journalists here and maybe even give your own opinion on one of the propositions we've touched on or one of the propositions that's in your mind as being important. And many of them are important, and as you've heard intimated here, many of them may be not as important, but we certainly do welcome your involvement. And I'll give out the number shortly. We're going to do segments on our BART board and on the soda tax measure, by the way. But I want to talk about the campaign. There are Board of Supervisors seats 1, 9, and 11 are all up for battle. Some WAG ones said recently you can tell who's a progressive and a moderate by who's getting two endorsements, SEIU, Tenants Union endorsements, and that's the difference between the two. That's a little bit reductive and simplistic, but let's talk about the campaign. Not only what's at stake, but the races. Marisa.
Yeah, so I'm in District 9, so maybe I'll start with that. This is Hillary Ronan, who's a longtime aide to current supervisor David Campos, and Joshua Arce, who is a favorite of the building trades and sort of that side of labor in San Francisco. You can't just say labor, right? There's always two sides. I think this has been an interesting one just because Hillary is so closely aligned with David Campos's policies and has worked in an aide for so long, and so she's very sort of in tune with the district and knows a lot of people, but Josh has done a lot of work. He actually helped push a lot of the community choice aggregation or worked around that issue, let's say. I don't want
to. let me give the number now, in fact, because I know there are many people who are going to weigh in here on these races, on the measures, as well as the campaigns, and an opportunity for you to also to comment on the future of San Francisco that is embedded in really reading them, and I hope you can give a close reading. There are so many to do that with. Bigger than Catcher in the Rye, maybe bigger than possibly bigger than Anna Karenina. But you can join us at our toll-free number. Let me invite you to do that. It's 866-733-6786. We're going to open our lines now, so feel free to join the program at 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. You want to talk about, there's also a race for District 5, which has gotten a lot of attention. London Breed, who grew up in the housing projects and running against Dean Preston, son of Holocaust survivors who moved to San Francisco at age 24. That's how it's being billed. I'm wondering why it's being billed that way, perhaps, but that's how elections often are billed.
We love those simple labels. It all works out. London Breed is a fascinating local politician. She's very outspoken. She has a lot of things to say. She, maybe to the surprise of some people, became president of the Board of Supervisors. I'm not as familiar with Mr. Preston, but that's turned into a pretty acrimonious battle.
Yes, it has.
And it's kind of been a surprise. You would think an incumbent who's president of the Board of Supervisors might not even have an opponent. And in fact, it's turned out to be quite the tussle. So we'll see how it goes.
Tim, you want to talk about 9 and 11?
Yeah. First of all, let me just say kind of in the geopolitics of this, the important thing to understand about the supervisors' races is that 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11, 6 seats are up, including 3 that are currently held by progressive supervisors who are termed out. So The progressives on the board have a 6-5 majority right now. If the progressives don't win a majority, or perhaps all of those six, the moderate side will retain their majority. So that's one of the reasons that D5 is so contentious.
Depending on what happens with
With the state Senate race. Right. But that's one of the reasons that District 5 has become such a linchpin, because it's not just about, and I was at the debate Thursday night where both candidates more or less agreed on this, it's not just about do you like London Breed or do you like Dean Preston? It's about who should control the Board of Supervisors. And Dean Preston is definitely part of one camp, and London Breed is definitely part of another camp. So we're actually seeing this in many of the contested races. We're seeing it in District 1, where you have Sandy Feuer, who is running as the progressive, against Marjane Feuer, who is running with the support of the more moderate faction.
And London Breed being the more moderate and Dean Preston
being the more progressive. Yeah. You know, District 3 is the only one where there really isn't a race, because nobody seriously is challenging Aaron Peskin. But in 1, 5, 9, and 11, there's really this contrast between candidates who are really representing what I would agree with my other colleagues here is a divided city in terms of policy.
Yeah. And a lot's at stake. I mean, let's talk about that. Marisa?
Well, you know, I think Tim mentioned it earlier. I think what a lot of these issues turn on, because again, like, and I know that everybody disagrees with me here, but when you step outside of San Francisco, these are all Democrats, right? We're not having fights over abortion or some of the sort of big linchpins of national politics. We're talking about what kind of development do you support? What kind of affordable housing requirements should be on developers? I mean, there are other issues too, but I think you guys would agree that development has become one of the bigger questions.
And displacement.
Always has been. But I think that's what's interesting is that, yes, people like us are going to frame it in this larger question of moderates versus progressives. But I think personally, as a San Franciscan, when you go to the polls and when you talk about who you will cast your vote for as supervisor, it's not necessarily going to break down for your average citizen on those lines. I think that people are going to vote for who they know, who they think that they have an understanding of. You know, politics is very personal, especially in a city like this. And so I think that if you're not sort of caught up in the, you know, if you're not going to City Hall every week and you're not going to marches and you're not as sort of intimately involved, you may not have the same point of view that we do here looking at it more broadly. So that, you know, I think it's fair to say I think London has a pretty strong chance of keeping her seat. I think that, you know, in Sandy Lee Feuer looks pretty good in District 1. Obviously, Peskin is going to keep his seat.
But I think that's
11 is a question.
Excuse me. We're coming up on a break. And I want to, again, encourage those of you listening. We're talking, trying to make sense of San Francisco's jam-packed November ballot, jam-packed with measures largely. But also there's a lot at stake, as I have reiterated, in terms of who the candidates are and what these measures are going to mean. I'd like to hear from you. I'd like to hear your thoughts, not only about the size of the ballot, but specific issues. And if you have concerns and if you have questions, please feel free to join us or comments. We welcome your calls. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. And you can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle's @KQED Forum, talking with C.W. Nevius of The Chronicle, Tim Redman of 48 Hills, and Marisa Lagos of KQED. This is KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about what's on the San Francisco ballot as part of our 2016 election coverage. And talking about the size of that ballot initially, it is sort of like somebody said, a ballot injected with steroids or something along those lines. You may indeed, as I said earlier, it's maybe too easy to get on the ballot. Only 5% of the votes that are cast in the most recent mayoral elections. How do you feel about the size of the ballot and how do you tackle all these issues would be a question to you, our listeners. But we're also interested in finding out what's on your mind with respect to candidates and with respect to measures and what you'd like to know about. I mean, we have three experts here with us who can answer probably most any question that may be on your mind with respect to what's on the ballot or what's in the measures. And you can join us again at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Again, our guests are Marisa Lagos, reporter for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk, Tim Redman, editor of 48hills.org, an online daily newspaper, in its third year. Congratulations, Tim.
Thank you.
And Chuck Nevius, C.W. Nevius, Metro columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. When did you decide to be C.W. rather than Chuck or Charles?
I used to be a school teacher, and they asked me not to use my first name. I was working part-time at the Colorado Springs Sun covering high school football. So I thought, for a lark, I'll use my initials. And they said, well, don't change it now. So I haven't.
Well, you're still kind of covering football in a sense, aren't you?
It's political football, Michael. It's political football. Can I say one thing that Marisa said earlier, and that just to piggyback on it, in some ways you also have to figure in the quirkiness of the San Francisco voter. Someone like Hillary Rodham is a great example of District 9. She looks like the kind of person District 9 would elect. She's progressive. She's right out of the David Campos pact. That's all that kind of stuff. However, if you look at District 1, I was so surprised. Eric Marr consistently carried District 1, and that's traditionally thought of as a pretty much family, maybe moderate kind of place. And Norman Yee is another case of someone who is in the western neighborhoods. You'd think those people would be very moderate. He votes very often with the progressives. He's a little quirky and so forth. And by all accounts, he's got a good chance of being reelected this time. So it is progressive, it is moderate, it is local, but there's also another factor, and it's very hard to predict.
Yeah, I think you'll see more of that moderate progressive sort of split on these ballot measures, honestly, because that's where people are asked for these issue questions, right, instead of like a candidate where you do have maybe a personal connection to them or somebody who knows them. Can I just jump in on one thing, too, that I was thinking about is, you know, in addition to just the length of it, you're asking voters for quite a bit of set-asides in this. This is where we earmark money at the ballot to pay for programs, which always sounds good, right? Like, who doesn't want to pay for seniors and adults with disabilities or transportation and homeless services or
trees,
arts and homeless families? But what that ends up doing is really tying the hands of our policymakers and decision makers. And so we've seen this at the state level. We've seen this at the local level. Everything is earmarked these days. And so when it comes to actually negotiating a budget, there's only like 1 or 2% of wiggle room. Also, just quickly, Prop A, which is a almost $750 million school bond measure, we also have a $9 billion statewide school bond measure on the ballot. And so I'm just interested to see how those interplay and what people do when they're asked both questions at once.
Yeah. Read a quick comment here from a listener named Deborah. Says, I'm furious at Prop V's barrage of mailers calling the soda tax a grocery tax. One mailer even showed a photo of a sandwich. If the soda industry needs to lie to voters in order to defeat the measure, Prop V deserves to pass. And Ryan writes, Rose Pack, sad news. Will this affect any races?
That's a good question. The Jane Kim situation would be the first to come to mind. And, you know, Jane was very upset, as many people were, when Rose passed away. But Rose was very much an advisor to Jane and rounded up support for Jane. And it's a good question to see. I'm assuming that Jane Kim will get lots of votes from Chinatown, but it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
And particularly since her opponent, Scott Wiener, is aggressively going after her in what you would think would be the Chinese and more Asian base, particularly with the tents and with these, you know, mailers going out saying, Jane Kim wants a tent on your front steps. Jane Kim wants a tent in front of your house. So he's going after her, and I don't know if, I mean, Rose Pack has already endorsed her and has already given her support, but with her missing in the last month of this race, we don't know.
We did a segment on Rose Pack, and of course she was a very beloved figure in this town, not only in Chinatown, but her influence was extraordinary, and Mayor Lee they were kind of on the outs, even though they sort of spoke amicably to one another. I don't know if that'll affect things posthumously.
Well, as she always said, you have to treat your enemies and your friends based on what you believe. And she could turn on a dime. I mean, she was on the outs with Mayor Lee, but then she also contributed $100,000 to his campaign. So she had her eye on the larger prize always. And that was what the power broker. Jane Kim told me a story one time that Rose Pack had this complicated thing that she was supposed to do. It was about the president of the Board of Supervisors, and Jane was supposed to go and put her name in, but not tell anyone she put her name in. And it turned out the whole thing was an elaborate switch to get somebody else elected. And it was so complicated, and she had thought so far ahead. It was just amazing.
But she understood how Byzantine politics could be and was very prescient.
Well,
we already eulogized her, and you know, she'll stay in memory here.
I would just guess that in that race, I don't see it playing a huge difference. I mean, I think that a lot of what Rose Pack did in Chinatown was voter mobilization, and that sort of infrastructure is in place through some of her allies that remain there. And so, you know, I think the question is not going to be this race, but sort of the future of politics and what she could have. And right. We'll never know because she's not here now.
Well,
but.
Let's go to our callers. Sean joins us first. Sean, you're on the air.
Oh, great. Thanks. Thanks, everyone. Just a quick question about how many voters are actually voting for the ballots and in the election? Can you guys give a predictable number or turnout? It just seems it was so embarrassing for Ed Lee when he won the mayorship with such a small amount of votes. So I'll take my answer off there.
Yeah, thank you for that question. Somebody saying earlier that it's likely that there will be more voter turnout because of the presidential race. But what about
it
the?
Well, that's generally what happens. And you know, I think that even though I don't think we really have to worry about Hillary Clinton winning California, I think there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be so frustrated at Donald Trump that we'll get a significant bump. The question is, will we get a bump as big as we did in the spring when it was Bernie Sanders versus Hillary Clinton, and we had huge turnout among Democrats? And, you know, many people credit that with putting Jane Kim in front of Scott Wiener. Some people call it the Bernie bump, but I'd call it the turnout bump. So we don't know how much the presidential race is going to impact turnout, but we do know that traditionally in presidential races, turnout in San Francisco, as in most of the country, is significantly higher.
We have so many disaffected voters, though, with this
Chuck
race. I wonder how many people are going to sit it out, or as many people have said, get to the bottom of the ballot. It's such a long ballot. You make it to the point where you say, you know what? I've exercised my democratic responsibility enough. I'm going to stop.
Or also just what the Trump effect is, because when you do have people who are on the conservative side of the spectrum in San Francisco are not uber conservative compared to the rest of the country and state. And so I do wonder if there might be some people who just say, I don't even want to. I'm not going to bother.
We'll get another caller on, and that's Mia. Morning.
Good morning. It was a great discussion. I'm a longtime District 5 resident, and I just would like to take issue a bit with the panels, and also most of our news coverage here locally that depicts London Breed's victory as sort of a slam dunk. I'd just like to remind you guys that 70 to 73% of District 5 residents are renters. And historically, we are the most progressive district in San Francisco. And when you look at the fact that the San Francisco Realtors Association, Airbnb, D.D. Wilsey, and developers have made major campaign contributions to London Breed's run, I just, you know, don't forget about that. That's pretty significant stuff. So, thank
you. Tim Redmond is nodding his head. Thank you for the call.
I was not one who said that District 5 is a slam dunk. I actually think that race could be closer than anyone expects, because you never know with district elections. And the thing in with districts is it's partially about turnout. It's partially about who you know, but it's also about a ground game. It's about who can go out and knock on doors and get their troops out. And I think the Dean Preston campaign has a very impressive ground game, although not the endorsements that other, you know, candidates have, not the money that London Breed will have. But I don't think that race is a slam dunk at all.
Wonder what you say to this tweet. Let me go to you, Chuck Navius. Listener tweets, the abundance of ballot questions restricting mayoral power is silly, in my opinion. I wish progressives would focus on winning citywide elections.
Well, I think that's the truth. When was the last time we elected a progressive mayor? It might have been Art Agnos. It's been a while, and that is the deal with citywide elections. We understand that we have district elections and that the individual concerns of different neighborhoods are taken care of. But once we vote citywide, very often it's a moderate vote. And I'm not completely sure that things are so awful under Mayor Lee. I know that people are concerned about displacement, but it was funny to hear Aaron Peskin say a few months ago, it might be nice to have a little economic downturn. I don't think many cities have ever said that. So I think we have money to manage what we're doing, and we need to use that money wisely. But I'm not sure that we're finding it to be a disastrous situation in San Francisco right now.
Can I just say, too, I mean, I do think Marisa that Lattis. Some of these are not going to, you know, change the game entirely. I think I would put in that camp, maybe even like the public advocate, the commission overseeing the mayor's office of housing and work, economic and workforce development. While advisory commissions are important, we have a gazillion of them already, and I think a lot of these voices are heard. I think Prop D, the vacancy appointments of the Board of Supes, does stand to change the game. And if you talk about wanting to win more elections, that one actually, I think, would have a huge impact. I mean, since I have lived in San Francisco, I have seen, I don't know, half a dozen people appointed to the Board of Supervisors by different mayors. I mean, this is not like a theoretical question. This happens very often because
most of
the
time. Can I ask you to flesh that out a little more?
Yeah. So essentially, you have most of the people, or I don't want to say most, but a lot of the people who run for the Board of Supervisors end up, they're career politicians. They want to go on to do something else. Tom Amiano, Mark Leno, went to the state Senate, Gavin Newsom. And so if you allow, or if you take away the mayor's power to appoint the board, these Board of Supervisors. So right now, if Jane Kim wins, the mayor will get to choose who replaces her, and that person will likely run for re-election and likely win because they are an incumbent. So this would essentially say that the mayor can put somebody in that place, but they will only be a caretaker. They are barred from running for office. And I think that that would really change a lot of the dynamics.
All right. I want to go to some of the measures for a moment here before I go to more callers. And Chuck Navius, I was saying that I don't know that you're on board with all of the Chronicle votes. I mean, for example, they're saying no on E. That's tree maintenance. And they're saying no on I. That's senior and disabled programs. And no on R, which is a 3% more of the police force into neighborhood crime. All of these things they feel should be taken care of in the regular budgetary fashion without necessarily putting them on the ballot. And they say the same thing about Y, which is a big issue, keeping small businesses essentially in groups in place. I mean, keeping particularly like people who have little art studios and that sort, again, to try to help the gentrification problem. So you going up against the big bosses here?
I've changed my mind, Michael. I'm going to go the other way now. No, I do. I go against them. I think that there's a reality and there's the theory. And the theory is, take tree maintenance, for example. The theory is the city should take care of its trees. There isn't any question about it. It's been unfair for years. The people who have a tree in front of their house have to pay for pruning. They have to pay for repairs to the sidewalk if the roots break through. We need to do that. And what's happened in the past is money has been set aside for tree maintenance. Then the city has some other crisis. They take that money away. The common phrase is they use it like a piggy bank. And those trees are not maintained. And we had a terrible accident up in North Beach, of course. We heard about that. This is one place where I would support a set aside because they have not in the past use that money wisely for tree maintenance. It's my wife always says it's like buying underwear. It's not that exciting. You know, it's something you have to do, but that's something that needs to be done. I would support that.
An interesting issue that you are not only in opposition to the official Chronicle position, but Ed Lee and the supervisors favor this. Where are you, Tim Redmond?
Well, I agree with Chuck. Oddly, I hate to say this, but it is a big deal. People are really upset about this. And the odd thing is, like, for years, until like 6 years ago, the city did this anyway.
Yeah.
So, in a perfect world, the Board of Supervisors would simply allocate that money, and the city would spend it. And it's only like $9 million a year, and the city ought to take this responsibility. I will say, it seems like a minor thing, but you go out into neighborhoods, and one of the reasons this is on the ballot is that I think every one of the district supervisors looked around and said, "You know what? This has got people really, really mad."
But they could have done it.
They could have, well, yeah, actually,
yeah, exactly
they,
right.
They could have funded it if the mayor and the Department of Public Works would have taken and spent that money. But they were worried that we've seen over the years, yeah, it hasn't happened. It's just that the city has decided to stick that on property owners, mm-hmm, and the property owners are absolutely furious. So I think that this was one of these things. It would have been better if the city, you're right, yeah, doesn't have to be on the ballot. But since it hasn't happened, I mean, that's why, it's kind of why historically we have the ballot process. You know, if things aren't happening at City Hall.
And I want to say, to be fair to Scott Wiener, who put this on here, because I'm about to say something that's not as nice to him, that this is an issue that he has been doing yeoman's work on for years. I mean, he really has tried to push this and do this and
he's
make
Mr. Trees.
He has worked hard. And again, like Chuck said, it's not sexy. And when budget time comes around and you're talking about homeless families versus trees, like, yes, but these are quality of life issues that voters care about. That said, so is Prop R in terms of neighborhood policing. But I cannot understand in my right mind, besides the Senate race and wanting a win, why the mayor and Scott Wiener are putting this on the ballot. It doesn't need to be on the ballot. Just do it. If the police department wants to do it, they can do it. And I was like reading about it because I'm not at City Hall as I used to for every single meeting. And I was going, well, is this something that the police department has opposed? This you know, earmarking of neighborhood crime units to really get at these quality of life issues? No, the police chief's on board. The mayor appoints the police chief. This is one of those ones where it's just like, okay, so is it just about burnishing your political credentials?
Yes.
Again, it's not a solution. It's a reaction. People are furious about the property crime. The smash and grabs are going nuts. Everybody knows that. And anyone who's been a victim of that is beside themselves. How in the world is it possible that the police cannot catch these people? So we'll say, okay, we'll create a special task force. But I think you're right. That's something that should be done anyhow. That's what the police are there for.
And it has an escape valve, right? It says if we don't have that magic number of 1,971 cops, which is what the city has decided and voters have decided is a fully staffed police department, they don't actually have to do this. So, right. Again, that's my rant for this morning. Okay?
No, that's a good rant. We'll go to more calls here. And by the way, you can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. Ariel, thank you for waiting. You're on.
Hi. My question is more about transportation and the future. To me, it seems that the budget numbers thrown out for BART and for the Chinatown extension are kind of astronomical. Wouldn't it make more sense to kind of look to the future and maybe a fleet of self-driving cars or something like that? I know other cities are exploring it. It just seems that we're kind of stuck in the past on this one with really high costs.
Yeah, what do you think? Tim?
Transportation is expensive.
Chuck Davies.
I mean, it's expensive to build trains. I mean, you know, it's the costs of construction and also partially, you know, land acquisition, all this stuff is very, very expensive. And the problem with the fleet of self-driving cars, besides the problems we all know about the potential of self-driving cars crashing into things, although people do that too, there's no room on the roads for them. I mean, you'd have to build two more bay bridges. You'd have to build a whole bunch. The crowding on the roads is because there's so many people and so many cars here. I don't see more cars as any kind of an answer. So, I mean, I think that our future is going to be dependent on things like rail. And I just don't really see any way around it.
I'd say two things. One is someone told me once.
Chuck Davies.
Someone told me once. No one dislikes a subway after it's been built, you know, but building it is a pain, and it's a pain right now, I'll tell you that. And the other thing was I was very surprised when the controller came out with the report about the Lyft and Uber and ride sharing that there's some 37,000 of those on the streets at all times. And part of the reason that we're so congested, maybe because those people are not driving to a parking lot and parking, they're staying on the streets. I'm a user of Lyft and Uber. I think it's a good service. It may very well be the beginning of what we have to do in transportation in San Francisco, but we're right now going through the throes of a complete change in the transportation policy and transportation problems in San Francisco and in the Bay Area.
Interesting question from a listener named John here. He says, what do your guests make of Mayor Ed Lee's communication director, Tony Winokur, taking a leave of absence from the mayor's office to run the campaigns against Prop D, H, L, and M? Does this show that Mayor Lee fears those four measures the most?
I mean, that's politics.
Yeah.
But it does show that he doesn't like them.
Right.
I mean, that's pretty clear.
He's
got his chief of staff going to run the campaigns against them. But interestingly, again, on the ballot arguments against these, you do not see the name Mayor Ed Lee. You see former Mayor Dianne Feinstein. You see former Mayor Gavin Newsom. Right. And I think that's because, well, Chuck said, you know, things may mean, you know, he doesn't think things are that awful under Ed Lee. Apparently, the voters disagree because his popularity ratings are so low right now that I think if the voters see Ed Lee's against it, they're going to vote for it. And if they think Ed Lee's for it.
You know, I'm struck by, for example, M, which is Affordable Housing and Development Commission, mm-hmm. is going to just establish another commission. It's supposed to be more transparency, but that's really what it's doing.
Well, it is, except that, I mean, and this gets into the minutiae of city government, but right now, an awful lot of the key development decisions in San Francisco do not go through the Planning Commission. They go through the Mayor's Office of Housing and Economic Development. That's where the real action is in terms of development in the city.
And that's why Winokur's working against it.
Right. Because so the idea here is you put a commission over that and because that's where the real planning happens. Right? So that is minutiae at City Hall, but that's why they're talking about this. It's not just another commission. It's let's look at where development is actually happening and let's try to get some oversight over it.
You know, there's a number of people who say if you really want development in San Francisco, you don't go to see the mayor, you go to see Peskin.
Well, you know, it's interesting because a smart developer, the first thing they're going to do is go to see the potential opposition.
Right.
I mean, if you want to get something built, you go to see the people who are going to be against it and say, what do I have to do so you're not against it? I mean, that's, you know.
Yeah. And go to see your district supervisor because right. there that is one thing right. that, given all of these yeah. Schisms, that there is some deference generally to a district supervisor and what they feel like something looks good, like and how good it is for their community.
I am an admirer of Aaron Peskin, and that's off the, that's off the record, by the way. I don't want that repeated.
You don't want that broadcast?
I don't want that broadcast
off the record, yeah.
However, I think the one thing that Aaron Peskin now has to do, and he has become a power broker, is he has to relinquish the power of no for the power of yes. And he has done a great job of stopping a lot of things that the mayor wanted to do and other people wanted to do. Now, what is it you're going to do? And I think that's where, if in fact he runs for mayor, that's where he's going to have to make his bones. And it'll be interesting to see what that is.
And we'll see what callers have to say. We go to you next, Anne. Thank you for waiting. You're on.
Oh, thank you so much for having this program. I just wanted to mention that I'm reading or starting to read Dark Money by Jane Myers, and it just caught my attention that I got a really slick flyer in the mail for Joshua Arce, and on it were no names, no telephone numbers, no addresses, just and even like a disclaimer that Arce wasn't even responsible for the flyer, but it said it was from San Franciscans for a City That Works. And it took me 2 days of navigating the Ethics Committee website to find out that that's basically the cops. And I love police officers, but Arce was accused of infiltrating the Democratic County, what is it?
Central Committee.
And he helped to veto a resolution for police reform. And if any district wants police reform right now, it's his district. And yet it was such a backhanded way. Do you know, he's gotten more than $50,000 from the police. And he went and vetoed what the Public Defenders Racial Justice Committee worked on for police reform. So it just... Besides other things, including, I live in Bernal Heights, and one of his flyers said that the Holly Park Bernal residents, you know, supported him, and we never, never gave him our endorsement. So I've just seen too much of that slick stuff, that kind of dark money that runs San Francisco supporting him. I do think that he's a prop. He's not a moderate.
You're all right. Thank you for your comment. Good to hear from you. Yeah. Anybody want to respond to that?
Well, first of all, you're my neighbor, so I'll say hi. I live near Holly Park also. I didn't get asked about that. No, but, you know, I mean, this is a much bigger issue than San Francisco, right? This is a problem at the state level. This is a problem at the national level. And I think that we have seen in the legislature this year and on the governor's desk reforms that would make it easier for these things to be disclosed die. I will mention also that if you are worried about good government measures, you should look into Prop T, which is on the ballot. This is to ban lobbyists from giving any gifts or political contributions to officials, elected or hopeful candidates. And, you know, whatever you think of it, I will just note that currently it is already illegal at the state level for lobbyists to ever give any campaign contributions. Personally, I think that should sort of be a non-starter. I don't understand why you would have people who are lobbying who can then turn around and cut a check. So
yeah. I'm going to call and bring another caller on. Gwen, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi. I live in Noe Valley, which is Scott Wiener's district. And one thing I like about him, he's visible. He's approachable. You see him shopping. And he helped me out with an issue a few years ago when the government shut down. And it was dealing with Medicare in the city and county. And city and county said, oh, you didn't sign up in time. So I called him, and he not only did he deal with it, he made sure it was resolved. Someone, one of his staffers called me and asked me, did it get resolved? And then a volunteer called. And that's what supervisors are supposed to do.
So you got your vote, obviously. Thank you. We'll let that stand. I mean, that's how supervisors do get votes. Reading a comment from a listener in District 11, Patricia says, your discussion highlights concerns we have here in District 11. We do not get represented, and District 11 does not even appear on many San Francisco maps. Your guests spend their time talking about the downtown and more affluent districts and do not bother with District 11. Likewise, John Avalos' agenda has been focused on the political tussles that City Hall, but he's been a poor representative for the specific concerns of his constituents. He was handpicked by Chris Daley for his progressive bona fides, and he is now handing the baton to a candidate who is active in SEIU and has political credentials, but is unknown in the neighborhood and has been involved in few, if any, initiatives. We are tired of it. Let's get that on the record. There's Natalie, who says, as a longtime taxpayer in the city of San Francisco, to the city of San Francisco, I wish the city would pay more attention to residents and less to developers. And a question from John is, is giving non-citizens the right to vote even constitutional?
We'll have to let the courts figure that out. I don't know. I mean, you know, somebody will no doubt challenge it. Some group will come in and file a suit, and we'll have to figure that out.
It's all part of the San Francisco tradition.
Be said for a number of these issues, I take it, or a number of these measures. Well, let's urge people to vote and get involved in the process. Is there anybody have any shorthand ideas with all these measures and getting through them?
Well, the San Francisco Bay Guardian will be doing endorsements, and that will be coming out in about a week. So that's one guide if you agree with the Bay Guardian's positions. I would also encourage people to look at other, you know, look at the groups that you support or are involved with. If you're confused by this, I mean, if you are a voter who is a tenant and supports what the tenants union usually does, look at what the tenants union is saying. If you're an environmentalist, look at what the Sierra Club is saying. Look to groups who you trust, because it's really hard for the average voter to read through every single one of these things.
And let me just say, keep listening to KQED. Because we are going to continue our election coverage. And thank you all. Thank you, Chuck. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Marisa. A very important and, I think, enlightening hour, and I appreciate your being with us. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Gucci, and Tina Lauerberg. Let me clear my throat. Excuse me for that. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Fun. Interns are Maxine Schofer-Wolf and Brandon Yu. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. And executive producer is Joanne Wallace. I thank you for listening, and you can continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.